Good morning. So, since as things have happened, I tried to have us finish up our semester with all the things we had in progress, and I think the schedule is reasonable, but I know it's not going to be reasonable for everyone. If you have circumstances, please contact me privately and we'll figure something out. I try to be careful usually with extensions near the end of the semester because we might need to talk about, can we really finish on the day our final is? And there are options for that, but that should be a special conversation. Also, you might notice there's one more homework that is due the last day of classes and has been on the calendar since the beginning of the semester. I anticipate keeping that there. My impression is usually students find that one of the easier assignments, so I don't think it's a problem, and it might need to be modified because of what lecture material we get to. That's on the rest of the semester. And last Thursday, we were finishing up talking about optimizations, and we talked about some more practical stuff, and that thinking about what we can do with compilers and what we can't do with compilers. And you can see that the assignments we have out, the homeworks, are all about doing these things by hand. And we learned, well, sometimes you don't need to do that, and that's great, and that's probably the most useful thing. Yes? No, is the screen supposed to be black? No, okay. Well, that will be a bonus for the people who see the recording. But it's just showing. Yes. Thank you for bringing that. Okay. So we mentioned about things compilers could do well and things that compilers couldn't do well. And we mentioned a couple problems that compilers have, which makes them not so good at doing these optimizations just for you, so you don't need to learn about them, you don't need to know how they work in order to make code fast. One big limitation compilers have is that people who make compilers are always fighting with people who say the compilers are too slow. And one way they deal with that as a practical matter is compilers usually work mostly a function at a time. Just because if you try to sort of analyze every function call and embed, figure out how does this make the function we're calling a special case, how does that make the function that function's calling a special case, and try to do all that logic, that's just too much. So compilers usually have this sort of guess that they should just do a function, each function, mostly separately. Not entirely, as we saw with inlining, there's some exceptions, but mostly separately. And this means that they might miss ways you could speed up code by taking advantage of things that happen between functions. Compilers also kind of have to guess at how your code's going to be used, and they need to guess in a way which is kind of safe. And this means that given the opportunity to do lots of loop unrolling, when you get that wrong, you make your executable really big. So they're probably going to avoid doing that a lot of the time, or even though it might be a good idea in some particular cases. And they're also not going to know, does this loop actually run a lot of times or not, typically, because if the loop has a variable in it, that variable's value is often for coming from input or something like that. The compiler just has no way of knowing that. And so needs to make a guess and do not do optimizations that are likely to slow things down if that guess is not right. Another big problem compilers have is with just making the code do the right thing. So we mentioned one big example of this, probably the most common issue, which is with aliasing, which means we have two names for one value. And most commonly this happens when we have two pointers that point to the same thing, possibly different parts of this of an array, or maybe just the same variable, but we have two names for the same thing somehow. And when this can happen, the compiler can't reorder calculations. It can't, like, keep things in registers unless it somehow proves that this won't be a problem. Like, if we're using a pointer, it has to worry, is this pointer the same as this pointer? And therefore, it's going to have to make sure it, like, stores things before to that one pointer before loading from the other one, and things like that. And that's going to slow down your code, because the compiler won't keep things in registers, it won't reorder optimizations to help with the cache, and things like that, when it can't eliminate those sorts of issues. And we talked about two specific optimizations, some of which compilers might do, some of which they might have trouble doing. So one was inlining. So this is the idea of taking a function, and rather than having a function call, where we have a call instruction, and a return instruction, and a bunch of stuff to get the arguments and get the return value, we're just going to copy the body of the function where it's used, and basically find and replace the arguments with what it was called with, and so on. And this is going to avoid the overhead of doing the actual function call work, and also it might allow the compiler to do other optimizations, like, for example, if the function, you know, if we have a function which, like, you know, checks the value of the argument, now the compiler could realize, oh, if I'm calling foo of 0 and I inline this, the compiler can say, oh, 0 equals 0, that's always true, I can get rid of that, for example. We also mentioned common patterns where we have redundant operations of loops. So one thing that comes up a bunch is when we have some sort of, you know, tests in our loops. We had an example of, we had two redundant, you know, tests of our loop iterator, and we could, like, divide it up into separate loops to handle that nicely. We also had mentioned sort of an example of, you know, accidentally recomputing a string length all the time, and that being a case where the compiler probably would have trouble, you know, optimizing that for us because of this mostly one function at a time issue. So questions about things we covered last time? Yes. Sorry? My what volume? Mic volume. Okay. Can I increase my mic volume? Probably. This more mic volume? Yeah, okay. Also might not be close enough. Okay. Better. Okay. Okay, so let's go to our topic for today. It's going to be another form of optimization, which, if you did the SIMD lab yesterday, you've seen sort of how it works. We're going to go into more detail about what it is and how to use it. So as an introduction, if you looked at Loop Lab, we had some reference solutions that we provided there. And at least on my desktop, you know, the original assembly was about 2 cycles. When I enrolled it, it was about 1 cycle per element. When I added accumulators, it was about 1/2 a cycle per element. But the optimized code I got from 2 compilers, which now aren't super recent, gets about 0.13 or 0.14 cycles per element. That seems exceptionally fast. And it makes it kind of sound like, you know, we can do not just 2 adds and 2 address calculations per cycle, but we can do, like, 8 adds and 8 address calculations per cycle or something like that. And it turns out we can, but not with the normal add instruction. So my desktop processor has more ALUs that do adds than, you know, than just the ones that are actually accessible to normal add instructions. So to use these, we have some special instructions that, in the case of my desktop processor, can add 16 pairs of shorts at once. So let's talk about how this works. I'll talk about this in this example with ints. So we have an instruction that does adds a bunch of things all at once. So how does that look? So I'm going to look at applying that to our this add function, where we just do, you know, set a to plus equals b element by element. Function does, and in this case I have a nice fixed size of 512 elements. And to take advantage of these special instructions that add lots of numbers at a time, I'm going to first unroll this loop. And I'm unrolling this loop because our instruction is going to do this entire operation. So we have a SIMD add instruction, and SIMD stands for single instruction, multiple data, which basically takes a little array of data, we'll call a vector, and adds it to another little array of data, and it adds it in this sense. It adds each pair together. It doesn't like take the full sum, it just adds each pair. And in this case, with ints, we can work with 8 ints in a vector, and my processor has some extra registers that can store 256 bits, which is the size of 8 ints on my system. So the assembly we're going to want to get is going to look like this. So we're going to have RAX here is going to be our loop index, sort of our index. And this is going to be represented as a number of bytes into A and B. And because I'm keeping it as a number of bytes, it's not going to be the same as I. It's going to be, you know, I represented as bytes, so it's going to increment, in this case, by 32, not 8. And this is commonly something a compiler would do for you. And first, I have this instruction, which is a funny version of move, that rather than moving just, you know, one value, it moves a vector of values. So in this case, its destination is one of these YMM registers. So my processor has registers YMM 0 through 15, which are 256-bit registers, which exist for the special single instruction multiple data instructions. So first I move A at the offset we're at into there, into YMM 0, then B into YMM 1, and then I have this special add instruction that adds pairs of values, and it happens to be called VPADD for the one that does pairs of integers. And there's actually a different version of this add instruction for different sizes. So if you want to add pairs of longs, there's a different instruction. If you want to add pairs of shorts, there's a different instruction. So you can see that this sort of idea is maybe a little less elegant from a instruction size point of view than our normal add instructions. And finally, once I do that add with this add instruction, which, unlike our normal add instruction, takes 3 operands, they just decided when they made this extension, gosh, maybe it wasn't so nice that we only have 2 operands for adds. So they added the 3rd. Then I move it back into the array A and continue with the loop. So questions on what this assembly does? So I have sort of a picture version here of what happens as we go through the loop, that we're going to load a bunch of 8 values from each array using this move instruction into these 2 vector registers. We're going to do an add. The result's going to go back into the first vector register, which is going to contain pairs added together. So we're going to take the first thing in this vector, add to the first thing in this vector, and second together, and so on. Yes?
So if there's some kind of protection for overflow when you're adding the pair so it doesn't flow into the next pair?
Question, is there some kind of protection for overflow when you're adding the pair so it doesn't go into the next pair?
Yeah,
Yes. So this ad is going to behave as far as the results in the same way as a normal, each ad is, would, it behaves as a normal 32-bit ad instruction would, as far as the results go, except for setting condition codes. Basically, these don't set condition codes. Does that answer your question? Yeah, so this is not just a big ad. This is, in fact, a bunch of ads. And the processors are on top. And what you can think of the processor manufacturers of doing is that they said, you know, we're going to build, rather than a normal ALU, we're going to build what we'll call a vector ALU, where it takes in not just one input value at a time, it takes in a bunch of input values and does all the same thing on them. In this case, it takes in 256 bits of input values and does the same operation on all of them, and we just built a really big ALU to do this. So in this example, I said basically what we did is we took like a normal ALU and we said, well, we're going to have vectors of four things. We'll call the parts of that vector lanes. That's common terminology we'll use. So we'll have four lanes in our ALU to handle that. Now, you might say, why would I build ALUs like this rather than just having separate actual ALUs? Because we saw with out-of-order processing, we could have like a whole bunch of instructions run at the same time, and that would be more flexible, a lot more flexible. Like here, I have to get all my values together in a single register. So what's the advantage there? Well, the advantage is that if we're thinking of implementing out-of-order processor stuff, there's a lot of stuff we had to add to make that work that is not part of our computation, and that would have to get bigger if we wanted to really take advantage of having more normal ALUs. We need to be able to fetch more instructions. We need to be able to store more instructions in our instruction queue. We need to have more logic to go through the instructions in the instruction queue and find which ones are ready. We need to have more logic to handle things like branch mispredictions, because now we have more instructions to undo. And so as we try to extend this out of order idea, we keep adding more and more control logic. And this vector instruction idea doesn't add much control logic. Basically, we have the same control logic we had for the non-vector versions of the instruction. Like the instruction queue is going to work in basically the same way, and the instruction fetch is going to work in the same way, and all the other parts of our pipeline are going to work in the same way. It just happens that rather than dealing with 64-bit values, we're dealing with 256-bit values. And this is sort of where the value is. So we added a lot of capacity by adding these vector instructions without really changing our control logic. And it turns out that on out-of-order processors, especially without vector instructions, a lot of the space on the chip that's not used by caches is used by control logic like this. It's used for branch prediction. It's used for instruction queues. It's used for the logic to do the instruction dispatch. It's used for the logic to do forwarding. All that stuff. Actually, there's not that much of the processor that's often used for actual computation. And supporting these vector instructions is kind of a way of undoing that. That you now have a way where you can have more actual computation logic without adding even more control logic to accompany it to kind of lose the benefit of that extra computation logic. So questions on why we'd add vector instructions. Okay. Now, vector instructions are something that compilers could use, right? So we saw compilers did use them in the case of our examples from Loop Lab. And you might say, why are we having you deal with them if compilers can just do it? And the answer is, well, they can just do it sometimes. But compilers are not amazing at using vector instructions. In particular, aliasing and things like that, and conditionals, and have your code having some operation where the processor didn't deem to add a vector instruction for it. All these things can easily make the compiler not use vector instructions. And I've generally found it's very non-intuitive what a compiler will and will not use vector instructions. Perhaps this will improve as compilers improve and as processors support sort of more flexible versions of these instructions. But the state, like at least as of only a few years ago, was pretty bad. So, as an example, GCC version 8.2 and Clang version 7 would generate vector instructions for the top loop and not the bottom loop. And the difference is the loop order. Very hard to figure out that would happen. And also, it's definitely the case you can make a good version that uses of both of these that uses vector instructions and obeys the loop order. But, you know, the compilers often have had trouble, and I think it's typically because, you know, they have basically some pattern matching to try to use vector instructions, and if your code doesn't fit their pattern, oops, too bad. So, if the compiler's not going to do it, what options do you have? And, well, one option is we could write assembly. We're going to do something that's, and if you did the lab, you did something that's not quite as bad as that. So the second option is we're going to have what we'll call intrinsic functions. So we're going to have special C functions the compiler is going to provide for us that are going to compile to particular vector instructions or short sequences of vector instructions. And these functions are basically always going to be inline to always turn into those instructions. So let's look at the code for doing the add with vector instructions. So we're going to use Intel's intrinsics, and I think Intel is bad at designing APIs, because at least they're bad at naming things in their C APIs. So we're going to have to deal with some unfortunate names. So here we have a type, which is called underscore underscore M256I, which is a type for 256 bits of integers. Intel uses the same type no matter what type of integers are contained there. In the hardware doesn't actually distinguish between whether we have 256 bits of integers or 256 bits of floating point numbers. But in the sort of intrinsics syntax, they have different types, but you can pass between them because in the hardware, they're really just one of those special vector registers, those YMM registers. So that's the type we're going to use. And the first thing and the last thing we do is we get a pointer to something of that type, so pointer to 256 bits of stuff, and we load it. And we don't load it by dereferencing, I load it by using this special function here, which represents that move instruction we saw earlier. And Intel has this kind of naming convention, so the 256-bit vector instruction intrinsics start with underscore mm256 underscore, which is, well, the 256 is because they're 256 bits. The mm is probably because the original version of these vector instructions they implemented was called the multimedia extension, so they've never walked away from that. And we have load, we have this SI256, which indicates, again, the type of value being acted on. For a load, like it's not really meaningful, but for something like an add, we need to know, you know, what types the vector is, more specifically than the 256i. And we have this u here for unaligned. So if you don't use load u, if you just use the normal load, that is an aligned load, and it will crash if your pointer is in a multiple of 32. And the reason why you'd want your pointer to be multiple of 32 is that will only require accessing one cache block and not two. But we generally won't care about that. So our first step is we load our vector of 8 values from A and our vector of 8 values from B. Then we're going to do a bunch of stuff. And we're going to store a result back to A. So I have something representing the move in the other direction, which is going to be called store instead of load. And I pass that a pointer to where I want to store and a vector of the values I want to store them. Also have the add instruction, and here we need to specify the type of things we're adding, and here I specify EPI 32 to mean 32-bit integers. And there's a different thing we'd specify for 16-bit integers or 64-bit integers, and so on. Because there are actually a bunch of different vector add instructions, and we have to tell the compiler which one we wanted to use. So questions about this add example? So this is our add example for adding ints. The vector instructions I mentioned for other sizes. So for example, if we wanted to do longs, the code would be similar, but we'd change to using longs in our array. We change to incrementing by 4 because that's how many longs fit in 256 bits. And we change our add to using EPI 64 to say use the vector add instruction that adds longs and not ints. So if we think of our int version, we can sort of annotate our picture with what things are called in our C code. Picture we saw from earlier. Questions? What's going on here? Okay, so there aren't questions about, and I forgot the store. Okay. It is a separate slide. So, there are questions? Let's do a little exercise. So here, I have two arrays of 8 longs. And remember that the way our vectors work, these are 256-bit vectors, so they can hold only 4 values at a time. So if we wanted to load foo into vectors, we'd have to load it in two times to load the whole thing. And this code does some stuff and changes the value of bar because with this store here. And my question is, what is the final value of bar? And I should mention, to be specific, WOLO, this is multiply. It's called WOLO because this multiplies and gives you the least significant bits. There's another version which will give you the upper 64 bits of the 128-bit multiply results, which usually we don't care about, but is available in the hardware. like some more time? Okay, so everyone, okay. Yes. After debt. And get least significant 64 bits. LS. I just wrote LS, but least significant 64 bits. So what you think a multiply would do. So there's a mul high, which does multiplies and only gives you the, and drops the least significant 64 bits and only gives you the higher bits. So this multiply is normal if there's no overflow. Who'd like some more time still? Okay, so let's start with two things. A, B, C, D, E, F, G. Okay, so most people said something else, which what I get. So our first step is we do these two adds. Well, first we load things. And what we're loading from foo of 0, so starting at this element 1 here, but we're loading 256 bits there, so we get the next 256 bits, which means we get 1, 1, 2, 2. And then we load starting at foo of 4, which is this 3 here. We get 256 bits there, which is 3, 3, 4, 4. And for bar, we load starting at bar 0, so we get 2, 2, 2, 3. So our first step is we take our 1, 1, 2, 2, and add it with 3, 3, 4, 4. And remember, we're adding each pair. So we add 1 plus 3 equals 4. Then we add 1 plus 3 equals 4. Then we add 2 plus 4 equals 6. And we add 2 plus 4 equals 6. So our result's initial value is going to be 4, 4, and 6. 4, 4, 6, 6. So that factor. Then I take this 4466 and I add it to bar, which you said was 2223. So we're taking 4466 and 2223, and we're going to multiply each pair. So we multiply the first pair, we get 8. Second pair, we get 8. Third pair, we get 12. Last pair, we get 18. And so that's going to be what goes in this result, the second value that the result variable has, and that gets stored at bar starting at index 4, and it takes 256 bits, so it's going to fill 4 array elements. So we're going to end up having this 33444 replaced with 881218, which is not one of the options. So the final value of bar should have been 2223, and then 881218. Questions how I computed that? Okay. So we've looked at how these instructions work. Let's look at an example of applying them to a problem which is a little more complicated. So we're going to look at how we can use these for a matrix or matrix multiply example we had from crash blocking. And I'm not going to actually do cache blocking on this, but commonly you would do cache blocking in addition to this vectorization. So to do vectorization, the first thing I'm going to want to do is I want to have a bunch of operations I can do with this one instruction. These single instructions that do a whole bunch of things at once, a bunch of loads at once, a whole bunch of stores at once. And usually the way I'll do that is I'll unroll my loop and I'll have a set of the appropriate number of operations. So that's going to be my first step here. Since we're working with ints, I'm going to unroll to get 8 copies because there are 8 things that fit in my vector. And my hope here is that I can use that vectorized multiply to do that 32-bit version of that vectorized multiply to do this multiply, and use the vectorized add to do this add. But we have a bit of a problem. So one problem you might notice is that it looks like for the multiply, I want to have a vector that contains not a bunch of consecutive things from A, but the same thing from A a bunch of times. That if I want to plan on using that multiply pairs of values instructions, I need to somehow duplicate this value from A a bunch of times first. Otherwise, this actually looks pretty good, that we have a bunch of values from B we want to load because we have good spatial locality. It turns out that we can load them with just all at once into a vector. Great. And the same thing is true with C for loading and storing them. So how are we going to do this? So we're going to have some different intrinsic functions. So we need to be able to multiply 32-bit values. That's this molo EPI 32, which corresponds to a particular type of vector multiply instruction. And there's actually an intrinsic to take a 32-bit value and load 8 copies of it to send it across the whole vector called set1. And this turns into typically 2 instructions. And basically, there's an instruction called broadcast that takes a single value and copies it to all the other slots in a vector. And why is there that instruction? Well, it's not because it's like super efficient to implement, it's because it's a really common thing you'd want to do. Because it's actually very common for us to have one value and want to apply it to a whole thing in a vector with a later operation, and this is how we're going to do that, by making a vector that contains lots of copies of that value. So now that we know we have tools to handle getting lots of copies of a value and doing our multiply, let's apply that. So I'm going to go through sort of, this is the inner loop we want to vectorize. I'm going to go through sort of how we handle each part of it. So first we have to deal with C. So I'm going to load this bunch of 8 things from C to do the plus equals, and then I'm going to change that, and then I'm going to store it back. So I have a a vector load to load 256 bits of stuff from C, starting at our first index, in a store, and I can use this one load instruction and this one store instruction because they're all together. If they weren't together, things get very ugly for us. We'd have a lot of trouble vectorizing this. I can do the same thing to load B, and for loading A, I'm going to use that set one intrinsic. So I'm gonna, you know, have it generate this instruction to actually take one thing from A and copy it a bunch of times into a vector. And then after that, I'm gonna use our multiply instruction with intrinsic to do the multiplication. So multiplying eight pairs of values, do those multiplies. After I do those multiplies, I can add the results of that multiply using our eight pairs of add instruction to C, and I have my store of C. And we end up with the code that looks like this, which would probably be a lot more readable if Intel didn't choose such horrible function names. Questions? So let's do here. So here I have some code, and I've tried to vectorize it. And I have two blanks in my vectorized version. I'm asking, what should I put in each of those blanks? And I vectorized it in a bit of different, I've done something a little different to actually get our, to vectorize this. So something you should note is that I have a different strategy here, where rather than sort of expanding the innermost loop, I've done something, some transformation on the I loop already. Like, that's a given. Who'd like some more time? Okay. Bunch of people. Okay. It might be helpful. Sort of a first step we can take here is we can look at A part and we can say that this contains, that A part is A of I plus 1, A of I plus 2, A of I plus 3 because of how this load works. So that's probably a useful way of thinking about what has to be going on here. Because that load loads 256 bits, that's four elements of A, not just one. who'd like some more time? Okay, so who thinks A? Who thinks B? Okay, who thinks C? Who thinks D? Okay, so I think the best answer is C. And the problem with B is that if we're skipping by four, we actually are only adding AI to, we aren't adding A, multiplying BI times every BJ. That we're only like multiplying B0 times B0, B4, B8, B12, B16, and so on. So we're skipping a bunch of cases. As for, like, how did I arrive at this solution? Well, if we look at our original code, what I did is I kind of did something kind of like cache blocking-esque to increase our spatial locality, because to load stuff into a vector, we want to have it all be spatially local. So it's the same trick we've done for cache blocking to increase spatial locality. Sort of I expanded the loops and unrolled things to get a loop like this, where I'm loading the same copy of BJ a bunch of times, but have this, some spatial locality in the A's and B's. And maybe say, why did I expand the I loop instead of the J loop? Isn't that expanding the J loop more straightforward? And it is more straightforward to do that, but this code here is very hard to vectorize relative to the previous code, because for this code, I need to somehow, I can do all these adds in parallel. No, I'd like to, but I can't really, because they're all adding to the same thing. And I can't, when I do the add four value pairs of values instructions, they're gonna go in four different places. I'm not gonna like have a combined result. I need to do extra work to get that combined result, which I absolutely could do, but that would be a bunch of extra steps. That's why I chose to vectorize it this way, and why this would probably, this top version would probably be the easiest way to vectorize it. So questions? Solution to that exercise. Yeah.
Why do we use set?
Because I'm loading, because what I want to, the vector I want to get is this vector, which contains a bunch of copies of BJ, not what I get with load, which would be, which would contain this vector down here, which contains BJ 0 plus 0 plus 1 plus 2 plus 3. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so that's most of what I have to say about vector instruction. Some sort of things about some annoying bookkeeping issues with the vector instructions. So commonly, when you're trying to vectorize real code, or the compiler is, we'll have values that aren't in the place we want in the vectors. And we won't have a good option like that set one. We'll have to like somehow rearrange the values ourselves to make them go in the right places. And there are instructions for doing this, because this is a very common operation, and it's very annoying to do without special instructions. Because sort of the easiest way of doing it without special instructions is like store the vector back to memory and like use a whole bunch of instructions to shuffle things around. So instead, there are special instructions for doing this, often called shuffling or swizzling or permuting. So usually you can do this operation in registers without like sending things to the stack. So for example, let's say I want to turn the vector 1234 into 3412. A way I can do this with the Intel intrinsics is like so. And you can see I had to encode this number indicating how I want things moved around that the instruction for this uses. I'm not expecting you to memorize this. I have to look this up every single time I use it. So, but I want you to know these thing operations exist, and you just have to look up how does the processor expect you to specify how you want to shuffle, move things around in the vectors. But there's operations for that because it's such a common operation, and you can't like do it the way you like would move things around in memory. So questions about shuffling. Okay. and sort of some historical and not x86 notes. So the vector instructions we've been looking at are part of Intel extensions called AVX and AVX2, which AMD has also adopted for the most part. There were earlier versions of these extensions that are still supported called SSE with various numbers. Those only had 128-bit registers, and they're still there. They're a subset of the 256-bit registers, just like EAX and REX. There's also a 512 version that, well, it exists. You can't use it on the assignment, so it's mostly not of interest. And we've only been looking at x86. Other ISAs have similar instructions. So ARM has something called Neon. MIPS has something called MSA. PowerPC has something called UltiVec or VMX. So there's versions of these sorts of instructions and other architectures. Obviously, sort of the intrinsic function sets and all that would be different. And also, perhaps more usefully, sort of the way GPUs work internally is a big part of how they work is that GPUs are essentially machines where most of the instructions are vector instructions. It's one of the big things GPUs do. And because of that sort of thing, there's other programming interfaces, most of which are kind of focused on GPUs, which have more flexible vector instructions because that's all they do, where you don't work with intrinsics, but you also don't work with like normal C code and expect the compiler to figure it out. So these are things like CUDA or OpenCL. And GCC also has some vector And related to this, I mentioned that like GPUs, like they're designed for vector instructions. So they have some features that Intel really didn't think of copying from the things that existed since the 90s or the 80s, that would be really useful, that do exist in some versions of vector instructions, and that Intel and other major processor manufacturers of general purpose processors have slowly started to add. So these include ways of handling conditionals. So here, let's say you want to add values, but not all of them. With vector instructions we've seen, that's really annoying. There's ways of doing it, but they're really annoying. The vector instructions could be designed to like let you do that in a more convenient way by like letting you specify a mask or something like that. You notice that we have to deal with vectors of a fixed length, and if you wanted 7 values, too bad. You don't got that. But there's some architectures where they've implemented features to help out with that, and GPUs commonly will handle that much more elegantly. And also you notice that our loads and stores only handle contiguous values, which is a real annoyance if you're thinking of code where like we skip by n sometimes. And often there are architectural support, like instructions that will not load like not values that are together, but a bunch of separated values. Obviously those instructions are pretty complicated to implement in hardware, but they can, they're at least they're for GPUs, they're considered worthwhile enough to do. And yes, as mentioned in the slide, some of these features are implemented in Intel's later extensions because they come up to say, gosh, these vector instructions are really annoying to use. Wonder why people got away with them, and they figured out, oh yeah, spend the extra effort to make them more useful. So that's, I think, everything I'm going to say about vector instructions. So questions on vector instructions. Okay, so vector instructions are last sort of how to optimize things, sort of major topic. We're gonna have one thing I meant to mention sort of from a practical point of view. So one practical thing I mentioned is if you're optimizing code, like just change your compiler flags first. Another practical thing is devote your effort in the right place. So the biggest way people, you know, mismanage their optimization effort is by optimizing things that don't matter. So, for example, if your program is spending 90% of its time reading files, probably optimizing its computation, you could do that. That would be great, but that's not worth it. And, you know, it's, you don't like to do that sort of thing. And commonly, people will make that mistake. You might say, why would that happen? Well, it will happen because you don't check where's the program spending its time. You'll assume, gosh, my program that multiplies big matrices is really slow, must be the multiply of the big matrices. Whereas maybe if you timed it, you'd realize, oh, my matrices are stored with these big text files and parsing numbers takes forever. And those sorts of things come up a lot in practice. And there's a particular type of tool you should use called profilers that are tools to measure where your program spends time. There's a whole bunch of them. On Linux, the one I'd recommend using, assuming you have appropriate administrator type access to the system, is called perf. And profilers give you output maybe something like this. So here is an example of profiler output from HTLRS. And you can see here there's these two columns from this profiler. There's one column labeled children and one labeled self. So the self column is the percent of time the profiler found me spending in each of these functions. So you can see here that I spent 31% of the time I was in this evaluate expression function. Evaluate expression function, and 23% of the time I was in a function that's part of a hash table implementation. And that's probably not something that's intuitive. You would think, HTLRS, is it slow? Does it take a while because of what? And it turns out, well, it's spending 29% of its time doing hash table stuff. You know, that's something I learned from this, and, you know, so if I wanted to make it faster, I need to worry about that. So, like, why are we spending so much time with hash tables? Could we fix that? There's also this children column, and this is the time spent in this function or anything it calls. So you can see for main, it's 100%, not because we're actually spending a lot of time in main itself, but because we're spending all our time in things that main calls. And we can see, like, for our expression evaluate function, it's 60% because, you know, we're spending 30% of the time about in that function itself and another 30% in things it calls. So that is sort of typically the sort of thing you'll get from a profiler, and this is where you should start if you're optimizing a real program, because you shouldn't just guess where the performance is being spent. Usually you'll be surprised on any non-trivial program. So questions about profilers? Case, we'll move on to starting talking about exceptions. So this is not optimizations. We're going to talk about, for the rest of the semester, about operating system support that the architecture does. So features the processor implements to make operating systems work. To know about that, we need to talk a bit about things that operating systems want to do. So I'm going to start with this. So here's some code. If I run this on Portal, so if I log into Portal, compile this program, then run it, can you still use that Portal machine successfully? Who thinks yes? Yes, that. If I run this program on Portal, you log into Portal 2, you try to run something, you'll be able to run things. Who thinks, yes, you will? Thinks, no, you won't. Okay. How about if that Portal machine only had one core? Thinks, yes, you'd be able to run things. Thinks, no, you would not be able to run things. Okay, so people thinks, no, you'd not be able to run things. So if you try this in practice, if I run this in Portal, you will absolutely be able to run things, even if the Portal machine only had one core. Things might not run quite as fast, but you'll still be able to run things. Your code will still run, even though this program is running. And if we look at what the code for this looks like, that is a little puzzling, because if we look at this code, there's nothing to jump to your code. And if we think of what's actually running on the processor, we're just running a bunch of jumps back to the beginning of this loop. There's no code in there that's going to let other code run. So what actually happens? And we can investigate this more by making a different version of that program, where instead of just running a loop that does nothing, here I'm running a loop that time's doing nothing. So I'm going to get the time, do nothing, get the time, and we'd expect that ignoring things like caches, which presumably everything's going to be a cache after a while, we get the same time every time. If we were running actually, directly on our processor, the way, our model for processors, how processors work from the assignments we did to build processors would be like. And that's not what we get. So here I have a graph of the times I got from this, and this graph has a log scale. So most of the time, the time I measured was 20 nanoseconds. Sometimes the time I measured was many milliseconds. So I have six orders of magnitude of difference. So what's causing that? We have these really slow times. What's causing that? Well, it turns out that we're doing something we'll call time multiplexing on that processor. That there are other things on that processor which get to use the processor somehow in between my instructions that don't ask for that to happen. So basically, my loop is running, and my loop doesn't actually get to use the processor all the time. Well, I guess to use it some of the time. And when my loop isn't using the processor, it just looks like things were really slow. That I had this move instruction that somehow took an extra million cycles. And what really happened in that move instruction is a bunch of other stuff was run. Like my web browser or my SSH client. And you might say, well, how did that happen? What did that? And well, it's the processor in cooperation with the operating system. So the operating system is going to do that. So what actually happens is that in between each of these programs, the operating system is going to run. And it's this special software we have which is responsible for managing all the programs on the system. So it gets to run somehow, and as it runs, it's going to change what's running on the processor. But we still have this problem that my loop doesn't ask the operating system to do anything. If we look at the assembly, there's nothing that says, hey, operating system, see if I should keep running. I didn't write that code. How is that happening? And what happens is that there's an event called an exception, which is a special type of hardware event where the hardware sees some condition is true and it's going to cause the operating system to run, even though something else might be running right now. So the operating system is going to run what's called an exception handler, and it's going to return from that and arrange for when it returns. It's going to tell the processor to stop running loop and start jump to the code of SSH. And this is even just on a single core. So basically what's going to happen here is that the OS is going to start running instead of a normal program because of this hardware mechanism called exceptions, which we're going to talk about later. And the OS is going to do a bunch of work to switch from one program to another. So the OS somehow needs to save where the program was and also all its registers, and it needs to load for that SSH its registers and where it was when it was last stopped. So this operation is called a context switch. So what the operating system is doing is it's saving the state of our loop and loading the state of SSH. We call this state that is loaded and saved the context of the programs. And that's sort of what the operating system is going to manage. So our context is going to include At least we might have some additions to this list later, but it's going to have all the values of registers. It's going to have the condition codes, because we could have stopped like in the middle of a compare. And it's going to have the program counter, so we know where to jump back to when we go back to the program. And sort of the context switch code that runs, it's going to do something. This is sort of pseudocode. It's going to take the place where the program was, it's going to save that somewhere in memory, it's going to save all the register values, and then it's going to store, this sort of copy all the register values that were saved earlier for a different program back into registers and jump to where that program is. And you might say, where are we saving this stuff? Where is this last and next? So these are going to be sort of data structures in the operating system's part of the memory. So the operating system is going to reserve a part of the memory for itself. So while we're running one program, which I'll call process A, the OS will have the values for process B's context stored in its memory. And then when the OS wants to switch, it's going to change the registers, have those values, and it's going to store process A's values in its memory instead. I'm going to kind of swap out between the two programs. Questions on this context switch idea? So the OS is going to store the save registers in the program counter of all the programs that aren't currently active on the CPU. So it can restore them later. It's also going to save, you know, save the old ones as it restores them, so we can go back to each program. Some people look confused, so I think I must have missed explaining something. Okay, so this handle switching from one program to another, so we're just saving all the registers, restoring all the registers, and the OS memory needs to have space for the registers for the programs that aren't currently active. There's something else we need to worry about, something else that you probably are aware of if you, given how programs work, and that we talked about very briefly at the beginning of the semester. But let's sort of see what our expectations are, think about what must be going on given what actually happens. So here, I have some code. For program A, I have a variable stored at address 10000 hex, which has the value 42, and this program reads that value into RAX. And here, I have program B, which is gonna run in the middle of A. So we're gonna assume that the OS is going to stop in the middle of this work here, save the registers of A, run B for a bit, then stop in the middle of B's work, and then save the registers of B and go back to A and restore its registers. My question is, if that happens, what is RAX going to be in A? Should be explicit, RAX in A. Who would like some more time? Okay, so who thinks A is 42? Doesn't matter, that program B did something to it, something. Thinks it's B. Thinks it's C. How about D, E, F, okay, some, G, H, no clue. Okay, so we're mostly no clue. So let's start with the simpler questions. Let's say only program A is running. What is the value of RAX? We wanna do that. Only program A is running. We don't have program B. The value of RAX in program A. would be 42. So remember the way AT&T syntax works, this specifies the memory address 0x10000. So we're loading from, so if program A is running alone, this is 42. And program B is trying to write to that same memory location, same address, the value 99. Is that what people were confused about? Yes, yes, no. So given that, we'd say if program A is running alone, definitely the result is 42. So then we have to think about what is program B doing? And it seems like what program B is doing is it's going to modify that memory location that program A reads from. So we'd expect to get a result of 99 based on that. But you might know, gosh, if I'm running on like portal, for example, if I SSH into portal and I write to a memory location, it sure would be really bad if I could modify your stuff. So hopefully that doesn't actually happen. And it turns out the answer is that it doesn't actually happen. And what our result's gonna be is that program A is always, always gonna get 42. And program B, well, program B might crash, or it might modify something that is not program A's data. But it's never actually going to change program A's variable. So how does that happen? Well, when we have these two programs, as far as what they think their memory is, they think they have memory with overlapping addresses. And this seems like, this seems really annoying to implement, right? Because it seems like that when we switch from program A to program B, we need to change the code that's loaded, right? We need to like copy out the old code, copy in the new code. That's a step I didn't tell you about the context switch. Now it does turn out, when I talked about that context switch, there was a step I missed, a very important step. And that is to change what the memory is of the program. But we're not gonna do that by actually loading data at the memory locations the program thinks it's using. Instead, we're gonna do this trick where we're gonna set a mapping for each program to give the program the illusion it has its own memory. What we're actually gonna do is the OS is gonna be setting this mapping that the hardware is gonna implement where every time the program tries to access a memory address like 10000, that 10,000, it's not gonna actually access address 10,000. Instead, it's gonna go through this mapping and it's gonna access a location specified by the OS when the OS set up that mapping. And the OS is gonna set up that mapping so program A and program B, when they access 10,000, they're gonna go to different places. And that's why we're gonna get this result here. And also I mentioned it might crash. So if you look at our layout, often we have sort of a bunch of unused space. So this mapping can also say to trigger an error. So what might happen is program A, it might have a mapping that goes here for address 10,000, and program B's mapping will just say, nope, and trigger an error. Error you might know as a segfault. So we're gonna talk for next time about the mechanism by which the OS gets to run, and then we're gonna talk about how this mapping is implemented, which will be our final topic for the semester, which is called virtual memory. That's all I have for today. See you next week.